Hello, and welcome to the New Books in Music podcast. In this episode, I speak with Benjamin Teitelbaum, the author of Lions of the North, Sounds of the New Nordic Radical Nationalism. In this podcast, we talk about the shifts in far-right music from the 1980s to the present. We also explore how the leaders of the far-right developed a new form of politics, of which music played a key part, and which focused on moving beyond disfranchised and working-class white men. It also meant moving beyond white power music and being skinheads. In its place, they embraced hip-hop, reggae, and some pop music, albeit with far-right themes. Last, we discussed the similarities and differences between the far-right of Sweden and the United States.
Well, let's start by exploring how this book came about. Why did you decide to write a book about the intersection of music and far-right politics in Sweden?
Well, Rich, it really was a matter of multiple smaller interests of mine coming together in this one project. I think that's the case for a lot of scholars. I was interested, on the one hand, on the connection between Swedish identity and music, and that's primarily for personal reasons. I'm part Swedish and part Jewish, and when I was younger, I was very interested in connecting with the Swedish side of my background, and music for me was a big part of that. So that's one side of this. The other half is a general interest in right-wing politics, in nationalism, and what some people would call organized racism in general, and in Scandinavia and in the Nordic countries in particular. Where that interest comes from, I'm not entirely sure, although I do spend some time in the book reflecting on it. But anyway, so those two features are there. And it so happens that in Scandinavia and throughout Western Europe, far-right political movements have had an unusual, some people might say, a disproportionate investment in music throughout a big chunk of their contemporary history. So this was an opportunity in general to study Swedish identity, national identity of the far right, and also the ways that music can participate in all of those things. So that's the short answer to the question. It's a big topic. Why we become interested in what we become interested in.
So I have sort of a method question, and one of the things that fascinated me about your book was you didn't just listen to a bunch of CDs or watch a bunch of YouTube videos and then try to make some claims about how this was working. So talk a little bit about the method that you employed in order to get at these issues.
So I did something that's not unheard of in the study of the far right, but that's still uncommon. I wrote this book, I did this research based on ethnography, which is to say I spent extended amount of time following, getting to know, interviewing, conversing with, socializing with, living with, in some cases, the people who I'm writing about. And, you know, of course, I listened to a lot of CDs and watched YouTube videos as well, but I was convinced from the beginning that you will learn more about these movements, you will learn more about the people, about their music and everything involved, if you're conversing with them. And your conversations with them will be more informed if you also know them to a certain degree. That's a core assumption that's made, I think, by contemporary cultural anthropology in the broadest sense. You know, that you will learn more about living populations and people if you come to know them personally, in the way that we talk about knowing somebody colloquially. But that's rarely done in the study of the radical right, for a number of reasons, of course. But that's how I elected to do this research.
And so what kind of relationships were you able to develop, and how were you able to sort of, I don't know, make sense of, but I don't know, deal with their viewpoints, especially someone who, as you said, at least identifies somewhat with being Jewish?
Well, it wasn't always easy. You know, not only am I Jewish, at least in the American context, I broadly, with some reservations, identify myself as being on the political left. You know, so there are a number of of ways in which, you know, my views and my identity can come into conflict with those of the people who I was studying. And there were plenty of moments and times when, you know, you were verbally attacked, or I found myself, you know, being threatened with physical violence, certainly uncomfortable, certainly put upon, to defend something about myself or my views or things like that. The thing is, which interests me, especially when I'm talking to people about items like this, Rich, is that, you know, all those experiences took place, but what was unexpected to me, for me, was were all the times when it was actually easier. You know, when, you know, the raging ideological political differences that I might feel between myself and someone else who I'm studying actually don't get in the way of interpersonal sympathies, don't get in the way of enjoying time that you spend with somebody, and don't necessarily prevent you from being able to learn from them or about them. You know, people have a capacity, we don't always want to recognize, but we have a capacity to identify with and find ways to like people that is fierce. It is a drive, I think, an instinct, at least in me, that can overcome quite a bit. I think if you spend enough time with somebody, you're prone to want to find a way to like them. Of course, the opposite can be true as well. Of course, we get annoyed with people we know very well, but that's not surprising. What was surprising to me was really how well I was able to get along with these people. I count a great number of them as friends, as a matter of fact, still today.
Interesting. Well, one of the things that I learned a lot from your book, but one of the things that I learned was that just how big of a change there's been in far right ideology and philosophy. So I think to understand your book, you have to kind of explain at least briefly where things were maybe 20 or 30 years ago and how things really changed during the 2000s.
Absolutely. And if you don't mind, Rich, there's a bit of a bridge between this and your last question, because one of the benefits of that kind of close contact with the people you study, it's the case, I think, with any phenomenon that you look at from a very, very close distance, is that it gets complicated. And in this case, my research did give me a vantage point to see just how complex and divided the far right is, the so-called far right. Sometimes that term is not even applicable to some parts of this scene. You know, we've seen from the 1980s, which was a moment of cultural either rebirth or birth, depending on how you want to look at it. That was a time when skinhead subculture and neo-Nazism exploded across Western Europe, and eventually it spreads to the United States, Australia, Canada, and so on. But at that time, the imagery, references to nostalgia for the Third Reich, was being used to confront contemporary multiculturalism and immigration. And cultural pluralism more generally, and progressive politics. And that, of course, adds an ideological and rhetorical character to all of the expressions that were coming from the far right, and at least who were involved in that scene. Chauvinistic, supremacist in racial terms, talking about a divine white race that has a mandate to lord over other groups. Explicitly anti-Semitic, anti-democratic, violent—all of those features belonged to that profile, to that earlier scene, and defined it such that it was the standard, and there were some other variations of it or countercultural movements within that scene. But really, we're talking about the most incendiary, vulgar expressions of white identity that one can muster in this day and age. But from the 1980s in Europe and in North America in particular, from that time forward, we can talk about a splintering of ideologies and expressive forms. And you could also talk in general about a process of moderation. That earlier skinhead movement was really, really good at shocking, inciting, and attracting the sympathy and participation of at least one sector of society, angry young white men, in almost all cases. But it wasn't very good at doing much else, but let alone organizing an electorally viable political movement. So much of what takes place from the 1980s up to the present is an effort to make the cause of opposing immigration, first and foremost, opposing multiculturalism, making those core agendas more palatable to a wider audience, and making them more effective as political messages in a number of ways. So we end up with, by the time we get to 2010, I'll skip ahead some years here. By the time we get ahead to 2010, we're talking about a cause that, on the one hand, has fewer and fewer thuggish, hooliganistic ambassadors walking around the streets, fewer and fewer angry young white men in combat boots fighting, spitting, cursing. On the other hand, one that has greater representation of ideological diversity. The people who I study in my book have very different understandings of what makes someone a Swede, for example. They have irreconcilable understandings of what makes somebody a Swede. There are cultural nationalists, let's say, who think that being Swedish does not in fact depend or hinge on your blood, on your ancestry, on any inherited biological trait. It's instead a cultural thing. And thus that anybody could move to Sweden and become Swedish. And their agenda is to see Sweden completely culturally homogenous. Contrast that with those who think that ethno-nationalists who think that being Swedish is exclusively or essentially a matter of blood and inherited traits. That's one ideological divide. There are other methodological divides that rage in this scene. But virtually all of them have tried in some way, if not their ideology, then in their culture, to get away from that old skinhead archetype, because they recognize it as being little more than a tool for rabble-rousing.
With this new configuration and this ideological diversity, how did music come to play sort of important sort of political piece?
So to answer that, we do have to go back briefly to the beginning. So when I say that skinhead neo-Nazism took over, white identity politics, explicit white identity politics in the 1980s, the tool of that takeover, the tool of the expansion, the mobilization, the attraction to angry young white men, it wasn't political speeches, it was not political parties, it was music. It was a genre of music called white power, comes out of Britain and spreads across Europe and North America thereafter. This shouldn't surprise, I would think, someone who follows a lot of social movements, especially if a political cause isn't represented in electoral politics that well. Turning to symbolic expression, turning to domains and areas of our culture where, you know, they might not have power in the real world, but they can paint another and alternative reality for themselves in which they're powerful. Music is great to do that. It energizes causes who want and seek power that they don't have. So this is the case for the radical right in the 80s. And the whole skinhead image, the whole lifestyle really becomes wedded to white identity politics thanks to music, thanks to white power music. Some of your listeners might know that skinhead fashion actually came from the West Indies. It has a very, very complicated history moving through Jamaica into Great Britain. So what eventually pulled that into politics was music. So if music was such an important part of skinhead identity in the past, you can bet that when later generations of anti-immigrant activists, of white identity politics activists, when they wanted to break away from their stereotypes, it had to traffic in music. you know, they had to comment on music in some way. And for some of them, this meant making new types of music. And for some of them, it meant saying, you know what, we're going to be a serious political cause and music should not have any part, any special role in us. We need to be a political party like any other. I don't know, the Democrats and the Republicans, you know, have their own record labels and music styles that they produce. You know, let's be normal politicians. So all of that is going on, but the big point, Rich, is that they had to address music because it was part of what they were trying to no longer be.
And so one of the sort of the real kind of treasures of the book is you talk about how hip hop and rap were employed, at least by a handful of artists, for this kind of far right or radical right message. And I think some of the real interesting work in your book examines those works and how they were understood and how audiences responded to them.
Yeah, it's, you know, I mean, bear in mind that, you know, these people are trying to break with expectations, break with stereotypes, and music can be a tool for doing that. We might not expect it. It might sound very funny, but, or not funny, just strange rather. But a good chunk of the music coming out of this later wave of nationalists has been hip hop, rap, and even reggae, in some cases. And in each case, there's of course part of us who could look at that and say that doesn't make any sense at all. Have these people just gone off the boat? Don't they realize rap and reggae and hip hop, that these are music styles that have their roots in and are associated with, you know, the Afro diasporic world, with African Americans, with diasporic populations throughout the West. On the other hand, there's a bizarre sense to it once you dig deep enough into the ideologies that are circulating these days. And I can give you an example, Rich. If we take reggae, for example, the white nationalists, in some cases, who are using reggae, define the genre as an expression of ethnic pride, opposition to globalization, opposition to oppression, and also a celebration for inter-ethnic brotherhood and for belonging and sense of place and respect for origins. So as soon as they define the genre in very general terms like that, they can find that it meshes, that those associations mesh fairly well with how they are wanting to portray themselves today. That is to say, they very few of them want to portray themselves as aggressive, chauvinistic white supremacists. Instead, they want to portray themselves as being victimized, under threat, standing up against a global network of that swirls capital and people around the world. They want to view themselves as protesters as well, underdogs who are fighting, you know, fighting for the preservation of their community. So when that conceptual framing takes place, these music genres become more attractive and in their minds, you know, more legitimate tools of expression. But it still sounds pretty funny. It still sounds pretty strange when you hear this music and you hear it advancing a political cause that you normally would think of as being the very antithesis of, let's say, you know, Bob Marley or Public Enemy or something like that.
But I think there was some discussion which you kind of analyze on the message boards, which shows that audiences at times could be ambivalent about how those musical forms were being used.
Yes, and even more complex yet, you know, in terms of their responses, there are some factions of this scene who think, you know, it doesn't really matter what style of music you use; it's just the messages. You know, in other words, instrumental sound has no identity, has no real association. It's all about the lyrics. So use whatever music genre you want, But let's not pretend like music impinges upon our identity, which is an odd way of discussing music. That's not unique to these actors, but it's still somewhat uncommon. Most people tend to think that music genres, styles carry some sort of inherent association, if not ethnic, then political or class-based or something like that.
Wouldn't this be particularly maybe problematic for like the cultural nationalists?
Yeah, this is an interesting, so to catch the listeners up, once again, there are types of nationalists. There are people who oppose immigration and multiculturalism because they want to see their native society retain its cultural profile. You know, they don't want to see more groups coming in because they're afraid that foods, clothing, religious practices, holidays, and so on are going to change. But they're not opposed ostensibly to racial diversity, as opposed to other people who are concerned about the actual bodies that are moving into a country and think in terms of gene pools and eugenics and miscegenation and things like that. So for the people who say that they're campaigning for cultural purity, they're the ones who at least should theoretically be opposed to this type of music making, who would not want to see people creating music that was not inherently Swedish, let's say, in its core, because if they're making patriotic music to rap or reggae, it's a self-defeating purpose. That is not Swedish culture in their mind. The tricky thing is that white power music, punk and metal music of the past, was itself imported Afro-diasporic music coming from rhythm and blues, has very little to do with Sweden, and why that counted as being Swedish or Swedish music, dare I say kosher music for these actors in the past, that's this is a problem. It's a big problem.
I guess this also does raise the question of why didn't these groups gravitate towards traditional Swedish folk music? Why wasn't that like the center of this sort of new right activity?
Yeah, it's a wonderful question, and this is something I treat in my fourth chapter. It was identified very much in the wake of this diversification of the musical output of the scene in Sweden. Then it was really discussed as a problem. You saw more and more magazine articles, internal discussions in the scene saying, well, wait a minute. Okay, so we don't – rap and reggae aren't okay with us because they're not inherently Swedish. That also forces us to reject some of the punk and metal music of the past. Well, what music is inherently Swedish? And for a portion of the scene, Swedish folk music, Scandinavian folk music became this new object of admiration. At the same time, they catch themselves, and I as a scholar, catch myself asking the question that you just asked me, Rich, which is why on earth hasn't this been something that you've been celebrating and enthusiastic about up until this point? And it reminds them, and I think it reminds us, that music styles like folk music today have a class profile to them, one that does not match that of the radical right in many cases. Practitioners of folk music in Scandinavia, much like in the United States, I think of sacred harp singing, in some cases bluegrass. You can have a rural, culturally, socially conservative faction, but it's also very much dominated by a revivalist population that is urban, white, in many cases, but highly educated, affluent, and politically left-leaning. It's not the sort of thing, it's not the sort of place where these people, former skinheads, angry young white men, find themselves naturally. And the fact that they fairly recently started thinking that, well, this should in fact be our music, has required a lot of actual groundwork, legwork. You know, they've founded their own festivals. They've gone out of their way to try and learn folk dances. They've gone out of their way to try and become educated listeners and consumers of the music. But one sees the process of construction here, that history needs to be overcome and that social boundaries need to be traversed in order to get these people to the type of music that they think they should be listening to.
And when I think of folk music in the United States, a lot of times I think about how someone like Pete Seeger, who was very involved with the Socialist Party and the Communist Party, very left-leaning, kind of took it over in the 1950s and 60s. And that I think to a certain extent, folk music, those are the practitioners of it, I think. Is there a similar thing in Sweden, and how did the folk musicians respond to this embrace?
I mean, it's very, very similar. You saw, you know, in the same way kind of folk music became in the United States, this way to reject commercialization, imperialism in some cases, you know, same thing is going on in Sweden. You know, folk music is a way for them to fight back against American popular culture in many cases. And this is a political left, first and foremost, that's doing that. And all of this means that, you know, today when we have a music scene, a folk music scene, populated by, you know, these 1960s, 70s hippies and their literal or kind of symbolic descendants, when they suddenly are finding all this new patronage and interest from their political opposites, this is a recipe for conflict. And folk musicians themselves in Sweden who are not part of the nationalist cause have been very, very bold, vociferous, and distancing themselves from this new push from the right. As I write in the book, it probably has given them more attention in media than they've had past 100 years, at least, if not ever. You know, folk musicians wanting to say, you know, we do not want to have anything to do with the right, let alone with nationalism, which is something that is a bit more pronounced in Sweden. The Swedish left has really looked with a great deal of skepticism on the idea of nationalism for quite some time.
Well, another thing that I thought was really interesting in your book is that you talk about how so much of sort of the musical culture, especially from the 80s and 90s, was really around white men. And you kind of asked the question, what is the role of female musicians in this new sort of vision or version of the right? And you actually identify a number of female musicians who've been fairly successful. So how did this new sort of approach to music create an opening for women to participate?
Well, it traffics in stereotypes. First, I mean, if we had a music culture of the past that was thuggish, aggressive, hateful, those are, you know, attitudes, postures that had been ascribed to men more often than not. In attempts to actually create a new sound for the scene, one direction of that was to say, well, let's create a softer, more relatable, more gentle, more vulnerable sort of musical demonstration of who we are and what we want. And for that, looking to women as embodiments of all of those stereotypes became attractive to both listeners and music producers and musicians alike. And the artist that I focus on in the book is a woman named Saga, who's arguably you know, the most successful female musician in the white nationalist music scene ever. She's from Sweden, and she doesn't sing white power music. There's not a lot of screaming or you know, kind of heavy sounding sounds coming in her songs. Instead, it is a light, airy pop, Madonna-like some people have compared it to Madonna, and sometimes exaggerated in its musical performances of vulnerability, of fear, of dread surrounding the demographics of white populations in the West, that whites are making a smaller and smaller portion proportion of the nations that they live in, and all of this talk about white genocide, about the fact that whites may soon become a minority in countries where they used to be a majority or preponderant majority. That has been the thrust of this music.
Well, excellent. Well, one of the things that kind of I really thought was just fascinating about your book was you talk about how some of these far-right theorists look to Gramsci to help them understand how to incorporate music in what they're doing. And that just sort of blew me away because I think of Gramsci as a figure of the left, and Gramsci has been so important for the cultural studies movement here in the United States. And so what was this vision of Gramsci and that these guys were talking about, and how does it maybe change or deepen or, make us look at Gramsci again?
Well, it's interesting. So Antonio Gramsci being this, a neo-Marxist theorist, in the late 1960s, early 70s, you started to see a lot of French intellectuals looking to Gramsci. And they were interested, especially in the ways that this guy understood power, and how he thought, in his case, that the left could go about gaining power in places where it previously had little of it. And the thing that Gramsci really wanted to see activists devote their time to was cultural campaigning, or cultural struggle, as it's sometimes called. And his basic belief was that starting political parties, having referendums and things like that, referenda, those aren't worthwhile endeavors if you don't have cultural values in place in a society and a population that are going to support them. So before you actually start the business of conducting official politics, you really need to change and shape a society's culture into such a position where your values are going to appear and be regarded as common sense. He upended traditional Marxist theory in that respect by saying that really you shouldn't, if you want to change the way society works, you shouldn't just think about material relationships. You shouldn't just think about economics. It's quite possible that culture and cultural values are the actual driver of human behavior. And the right looked at those theories, compared them to the history of post-war Europe, and said, Antonio Gramsci, a guy who's writing, during World War II, in most instances, was prophetic. He basically saw the way that the left took power in Europe, especially when you get to the 60s and forward, that what they did is they invested in all of the avenues, all of the arenas where culture, where opinions and common sense are formed. The left infiltrated in their mind universities, media, and by doing that, it really didn't matter what political parties were contesting elections, because they all had to form themselves to what counted as consensus in society. And taking that lesson then, I'm getting back around to your question here, Rich, taking that lesson, they said, well, we need to do the same thing. Let's not start new anti-immigrant white identity political parties or anything of the sort. Let's start seeing if we can't, on the one hand, maybe infiltrate some of these institutions, the media, entertainment, universities and so on. Let's also see if we can't just start producing our own versions of this side by side with the mainstream one. And maybe it will get big enough and attract so many people that we start to see the penetration of our ideas and our values wider in society. If we do that, maybe someday electoral politics will actually become viable again in a way that it wasn't and hasn't been since World War II. That's the basic idea. That's what Gramsci inspired for them. And you know, they don't always, you know, you've heard, and I've been speaking right now about culture. They don't always specify, and Gramsci wasn't always especially clear as to what that means. But music for a lot of people is part of it. If music is a certain place where people turn to prior to politics to form opinions, to form identities, to form a sense of right and wrong, and what they think is not only virtuous but also beautiful, then music is a legitimate place for people with lofty political aspirations to invest their time and energies.
That's a great point, because one of the things that I was observing as I was reading your book was that so many books about, or so many scholarly books about music that engage politics are all about left politics. And I guess I was curious what you were thinking about how your book, how it kind of challenges maybe some of the underlying assumptions in a lot of the scholarly literature about popular music. You don't really talk about it directly in the book, but it seems like you must have been thinking about that as you were working on your project.
Yeah, I mean, there is, you know, when I hear you saying that, Rich, what I think about is the general impression that protest, the arts, if we just stick with those two, protest and the arts, that those are implicitly the property of the left. And some might also go further to say that, you know, some people do. There's a scholar in my field, Timothy Rice, who writes about this, that music tends to have a positive valence to it, that it tends to be associated with goodness, first and foremost. That doesn't mean that people aren't aware that music can be bad or corrupting, or they might have some fear that, you know, if their children listen to the wrong type of music, they're going to turn into monsters and so on. But we tend to approach, I think, music in many cases, and at least in the West, as thinking that this is something good. You know, so this study, this book certainly can qualify that. Certainly adds something to our notion of what it is, treats it more as a sort of blank signifier that can be utilized and filled with a wide range of not just political ideologies, but even if we want to talk about moral or immoral agendas. All that is there. But is that what you were referring to when you think about the... Yeah.
Right. I mean, it seems like there's a lot of assumptions that music is just inherently sort of the voice of the oppressed, and the left is here to kind of help explain it. But as I was reading your book, it seemed like music might be able to go in any direction if we acknowledge it, and that maybe some of what we've been seeing is maybe left protest maybe isn't protesting as much as we think.
Yeah, I mean that can. It's interesting. We wouldn't want to. It might be, if I can catch myself. It might be too much to say that it's really a blank signifier, because there are parallels between these uses of music and those that you would see in the 1960s, the anti-war. At the very, very least, there's a self-conception among the people who are involved that they are rebels. In a certain sense, that they are using music as a tool to fight against forces that they can't necessarily confront by other means. You know, if they aren't an actual politician in a position of power, you know, what do you do? You know, in this case, you turn to the symbolic expression. There's lots of things to say about that. There are people who would not want to grant the same level of marginalization or oppression or downtroddenness in general to white men of all people. But it's be that as it may, it still belongs to their self impressions of themselves. And if that's the case, maybe it's not that wild of a thing that they turn to music to express themselves.
Right, which would mean that maybe the music isn't what we always thought it was. Well, before we get ready to go, I have to ask you about how the changes in the right in Sweden help us maybe better understand what's been happening in the United States. I read this book after Charlottesville, so to me that was on my mind. What kind of lessons do you think we can take from Sweden's experience as we think about what's happening in the U.S.?
Well, one is that context matters. We can't have a tendency, and a lot of people have done this, to say that what is taking place in the United States is the continuation of a trend that really, really starts in Europe. Right-wing populism. You know, Donald Trump has taken the mantle of Le Pen, of Wilders, of all these firebrands, right-wing firebrands on the continent, and made it successful to a greater extent in the American system. You know, one thing that I hope my book would do for someone looking at that is to put a little bit the brakes on those comparisons a bit. Of course, there's a lot that's valid to that, but it's worth pointing out that, you know, the particular history of the United States, our history of slavery, our status having been forged somewhat arguably, not really arguably, in the fires of liberalism, of universalism, makes American identity, makes implicit and explicit white activism mean something very different here. We also have a mainstream right in this country that is much more diversified, maybe even more conservative, culturally conservative than there was at all in Sweden. I can make this more concrete for you, Rich, by saying that, say, the Sweden Democrats, a nationalist party that came into the Swedish parliament in 2010, a lot of people compare them to Donald Trump. Ideologically, the current leadership of that party might be somewhere, if you want to talk in scales, toward the middle of the American Republican Party. These would not be ideas that would be the stuff of any rebellion or any anti-establishment protests in the United States. They're just milder because Sweden's political context to begin with is to the left of the United States. So that's, you know, that's a big thing to bear in mind right there. But also, you know, as we think about where this is going and what factors tend to be in place, what we have seen in Sweden and in Europe, another thing to remember is that a lot of the power for an insurgent right, for a radical right, whatever that means in relative terms, its fate, its fortunes tend to rest in the hands of the mainstream right. One thing that has strengthened, I would say, the right in Sweden to a certain extent, but also kept it from formal power, has been the fact that the mainstream right in Sweden has refused to allow this fringe into the government. They refused to partner with them. They did not go into any coalition. That means that the Sweden Democrats are the main opposition force. They've grown in sympathy, but they aren't actually involved in a lot of direct formal decision making. You could compare that to the United States, where you have two different factions of the American Republican Party, and really the fortunes of Donald Trump, we could say, rest, it seems, increasingly in the hands of people like Mitch McConnell, Lindsey Graham, and Paul Ryan, the establishment mainstream right. If they accommodate Trump, then he has power. If they refuse to, then he doesn't. That sort of dance that we saw in Europe playing out is now playing out within an actual party in the United States, as opposed to, you know, among parties in a coalition there. in ways that are quite illustrative, I think.
Well, this has been fantastic. Thank you for taking time to speak with me today. But before we go, is there any project you're working on now?
Yes, my current project, I actually am turning away from music to study a book. The topic is right-wing Orientalism. I'm interested in Western conservatives who feel hopeless as they look to the future and believe, regardless of elections, that the West is lost to liberalism. And a portion of these people are trying to remedy that by connecting or migrating to the East. So white nationalists, Hare Krishnas and Sufists, evangelical Christians who are moving even to Muslim, majority Muslim countries, anti-immigrant men in the West who are marrying Asian women. Those are some of the case studies that I'm looking at.
Well, that sounds fascinating too. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you, Rich.
You've been listening to the New Books in Music podcast. Today, I've been talking with Benjamin Teitelbaum, the author of Lions of the North, Sounds of the New Nordic Radical Nationalism. This is your host, Richard Scherr. Thank you for listening.